Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is the discussion portion of The Tyranny of Control, part of Volume 2 of the 10-part public television series Free to Choose. Milton Friedman is joined by other distinguished guests at the University of Chicago to discuss some of the ideas presented in the documentary segment of The Tyranny of Control. Listen now, and don't forget to subscribe to get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
This film has set me on edge. There is political, social, ethical considerations which do not reflect in the economic philosophy put out. There is a pervading feeling in this that the individual worker is to be totally sacrificed for the overall good of society. I don't see how possibly you can sacrifice individuals for overall good for society, because society is nothing but those millions and millions of individuals put together. And nowhere is there any consideration given to the social and the ethical aspects of the free trade formula that you advocate.
Let's get other views now around the group. What's your reaction, Dom Rumsfeld, as a businessman, to the idea that Milton Friedman has advanced that America ought to buy in the cheapest markets, the cheapest goods, without protecting against them?
I swore I would never even try to defend Milton Friedman, and I won't. But let me comment first on Dick's comment. It bothers me to hear social and moral arguments invoked in an issue like this, because it seems to me the measure is what actually happens to human beings. Each individual ought to be concerned about humanity. For a single individual who's unemployed, that's 100% unemployment.
Absolutely.
And we recognize that. I recognize that. But the real world is, if you, as the film did, go to India, if you want to see things that one can describe as inhumane and poverty and problems of human beings, they exist. And the test ought to be what works, what in fact will provide a circumstance that will be more dynamic and more productive in the world.
It is true that in the long run we would all be better off with free trade. I agree with Milton. But it's the short run that matters. And in the short run there are serious adjustment problems. Now, there's no question that the developing countries need access to markets such as American markets. And America needs them to export so that they can export more to developing countries. American exports to developing countries have moved from something like 20% of total exports to 30% over the last 10 years. But the adjustment is important, because what is happening at present is that it's not just a random group of workers that is affected by this trade. It's the most disadvantaged and underprivileged workers in America which are being affected. And they are, by and large, women and members of minorities in garments, in electronics. And I think that the adjustment consists of action on both the developing and the developed country sides. But on the, let's take the American side. On the American side, the unions and industry, I think, have to get off discussion about moral issues and get their act in order.
I couldn't agree more with Helen. I think there is a very valid income distributional problem involved here. Certainly society gets better off. Consumers get better off as a result of cheaper imports, and I'm all for that, and there I agree completely with Milton. But if the incidence of the adjustment falls on disadvantaged groups, then you would want to do something about it. It just really becomes an ethical issue. But the other point which I think Milton does bring up, which I disagree sharply with, is suppose if foreign governments do subsidize and actively promote exports to you, should you just sit back and just say, well, we're going to be better off as a result of this? I don't think that takes into account the fact that the whole international system can break down as a result of what people perceive in pluralistic economies as unfair competition emerging. And I think this is really what you're beginning to see. So we do need some sanctions. I mean, I may receive stolen property and I'm better off. Of course I'm better off. But if as a result of this I encourage theft, I think few people would agree that that was something one didn't want to worry about.
Before I call in Milton Friedman on this, a reaction to the comments?
Yes, really to Don and to Helen. Don, you choose to set aside, or you appear to choose to set aside, the social and the ethical considerations.
And not at all. What I said was you have to put the fact on a scale that there are social and ethical considerations with a free market or without one. And the tendency is for people to invoke morality only on their side and not to recognize that there are problems of human being in this world that are going to occur in each case, and the measure or the test ought to be what actually happens out there and address that question.
But you must also very much consider the social aspect of this situation. Helen's comment, the short-term displacement. I have a question for Milton at this point. How long do you put as a timetable on the displacement of these people, of these workers? 5 years, 10 years, a generation? How long will it be before overall society, you know, balances itself out and the individual is no longer hurt?
Let me take your last question first and then go to your basic question. I have always been in favor of phasing out tariffs over a 5-year period, a 20% reduction a year for 5 years to give people time to adjust. Now to your fundamental issue. I thought I had heard every objection to my views imaginable. But you are the first one who has ever accused me of putting the interests of society as a whole ahead of the interests of individuals. If there's one element in my social philosophy, in my ethical philosophy that's predominant, it is that the ultimate unit is the human being, the individual, and that society is a means whereby we jointly achieve our objectives. I would argue that the social and moral issues are all on the side of free trade, that it is you and people like you who introduce protection, who are the ones who are violating fundamental social and moral issues. Tell me, what trade union represents the workers who are displaced because high tariffs reduce exports from this country? Because high tariffs make steel, for example, or other goods more expensive. As a result, those industries which use steel have to charge higher prices. They have fewer employees. The export industries that would grow up to balance the imports, tell me, what union represents them? What moral and ethical view do you have about their interests?
You still haven't answered my basic question. How long of a time period? How long of a frame? 5 years, 10 years, a generation?
I said 5 years.
And could we be clear, Milton, on this point? You're saying, though, that tariffs should be phased out over 5 years, regardless of the action of other countries. It's not a sort of negotiation.
Regardless of the actions of other countries. So far, obviously, I would prefer to have other countries reduce their tariffs.
But if they don't move, America should move.
Absolutely.
Now, you go along with that, Don Rumsfeld.
In other words, you're against reciprocal.
I'm not
against. You favor getting to truly reciprocal trade, but you're willing to get there unilaterally.
Yeah.
It seems to me that it's probably worth moving in that direction. I don't know where I would stop. I am not.
Well, it's a 5-year program. Will you buy that?
Well, it seems to me that you get action reaction. To the extent you're doing something that makes sense for human beings, presumably that would be persuasive with others. Presumably, there would be a logical sequence where other countries would begin to sense that had a certain degree of validity in the world.
Will that happen, Helen Hughes?
Providing you do something for the displaced workers in the country in which they're displaced. Because if you don't do something, if you don't take some action, and it's generally got to be government action, you'll get such a backlash that you'll be back in the 30s with the sort of thing that happened with high unemployment.
Milton, there's a direct challenge. What would you do about displaced workers, or let the slack be taken up by others?
I believe that you have to separate and should separate sharply the issue of what you do about people in distress from how you handle the industrial system. I do not believe you ought to have a special program for displaced workers. What you ought to have, and what all societies do have, is some mechanism, voluntary or governmental, which will assist people in distress. We have another program in this series which deals with exactly that issue, and in which I come out, as you know, in favor of a negative income tax as a way to do it. But I think it's a great mistake to try to link it directly with tariffs. And the reason is that many people who are displaced are not in trouble. Many of those have good alternatives. Some of them will benefit from it. There are some who will be in distress, of course, but there are always people who are in distress for all sorts of reasons. In a dynamic society, demands are going up here, demands are going up there. There is no more reason, in my opinion, to have a special program for those who are displaced because of the changes in demand and supply on the international scene than because of the changes on the domestic scene.
Quick reaction to that.
Why would you want to return to a concept that this country had in 1900? Why would you want to return to where a few control the economic destiny of every working man and woman?
It's exactly the other way, Mr. Deason. The best way to limit the control of a few is free trade on a worldwide basis. There is no measure whatsoever that would do more to prevent private monopoly development than complete free trade. It would be far more effective than all the antitrust suits
totally
in the world.
I totally disagree. You would wind up with a situation like in the movie Rollerball, where corporations carved out their spheres of economic influence throughout the world and controlled everything. It would be controlled by corporations in its entirety.
Excuse me, you saw the picture of Hong Kong, didn't you?
Yes.
Where are those corporations there?
We might get down that alley and have a difficulty finding our way out of it. Could we move to another big theme in the film? That is that the third world countries have, broadly speaking, made a very serious error in moving into planned economies from beginning to end. And you use a phrase in the case of India, central planning has condemned the Indian masses to poverty and misery. Now, what's your reaction, Professor?
I partly agree with Milton as well as I largely disagree with him. I think it is true that the invisible hand ought to be seen more in the poor countries than it is. And I would like to see the iron fist disappear. Unfortunately, it's the other way around. On the other hand, I think it cannot be maintained that laissez-faire is the answer, either that it's a necessary or a sufficient condition for development. Now, let me go to Milton's examples and refer to Japan. Japan is a prime example, actually, where the visible hand is invisible to everybody who's outside of Japan, but it's writ large on the wall for the Japanese. The Japanese government, right from the Meiji Restoration, has taken a very active interest in the development of the country. It has regulated technology imports even to this date. The government and business have a sort of strong symbiotic relationship. I think it's just the last.
Highly paternalistic.
And business is highly paternalistic. I don't think it's a valid example at all of what I believe was the implication of Milton's program.
Let's bring in Helen Hughes. On this theme, has the third world made a disastrous mistake in almost unanimously moving into planned economies rather than the free market?
Well, first of all, it hasn't almost unanimously moved into planned economies.
Overwhelmingly so.
Not even overwhelmingly. I mean, India is a large country, but the majority of developing countries are not centrally planned. They have some sort of planning. Secondly, some of the countries which have been most successful have had the highest government intervention. The best examples are Taiwan, Korea, Brazil, Singapore. And even in Hong Kong, which is often held up as an example of no government intervention, I mean, this is just not true. The Hong Kong government has provided the infrastructure. It has provided the roads and the ports and the schools, and it's been very important. But when you move to a country like Malawi or Papua New Guinea, you can't do without government intervention. There is nothing there. There are no entrepreneurs in place, and the American entrepreneurs are not interested in small places like that.
I'm not in favor of no government intervention. I never have been. I point out in the film that what the government did in Hong Kong was very important. The question is what kind of intervention? And in the states you've described, in the places you've described where you've had success, governmental intervention has been of a rather special kind. It has provided infrastructure. It has not tried to determine the outline of industrial production, the areas in which industry should go, exactly what the allocation of. It has not gone in for central planning.
Well, that's just not true in Korea. I mean, you're factually wrong because in Korea, the government
has
actually...
Oh, it is true in Taiwan.
It's fairly true in Taiwan, but not in Korea, which has grown faster than any other country, where Korean exports have been determined to a very large extent by direct government intervention. I think your point is, what sort of government intervention, what for, and what are the trade-offs between government intervention and the free market? These are the relevant issues.
What is the role of government in relation to the market economy? How do you see it performing, Don Rumsfeld? Do you want to see governments, as it were, enforcing competition by chasing down monopoly, restricted practices, and all the rest in the society?
The record's clear that they don't do it well. They can't manage the...
But does that mean they shouldn't
take
do it
the wage
at all
price controls
better?
In the United States of America. I happen to have been involved, and I don't say it with any great pride. The real world is, I don't care about good intentions. I don't care about brains. I don't care about integrity. The fact of the matter is, they're not smart enough to manage the wages and prices of every American 215 million strong. They can't do it well. They do it poorly. And the weight of that is harmful. It's graphically shown in every document issued by the Council of Economic Advisers in the United States.
But what about the additional question, though? Does the government properly, in this country or elsewhere, ensure competition by other devices? I'm not talking now about price control, wage control, but ensuring competition rather than permitting price fixing or agreements and monopoly. What do you feel about it?
I feel the government properly acts in that area. The government must be there to ensure competition.
The government's not smart enough. Look at the antitrust law. You talk about implementation of antitrust regulations in the United States between the Department of Justice and the FTC. It's a patchwork mess. There isn't any logic to it. People don't know what to do. They can't get answers. They're inhibited from mergers and consolidations that would make a lot of sense from the standpoint of the consumer.
And would make even more sense from the point of multinational corporations.
I think that one of the points you're making is that it's very hard for the government to intervene in a very large country like India or the United States. But compare government intervention in some of the small homogeneous countries of Europe or a Singapore. And I think that's very important. Switzerland has a great deal of government intervention. Sweden, Denmark, Norway. I've just quoted you the four highest income countries in the world. They do have intervention to try and protect the functioning of the market system and to make it more efficient.
Milton is absolutely right that if you're talking about central planning, that has been disastrous, absolutely, in terms of having targeted industrial allocations and so on. I mean, there's absolutely no doubt in anybody's mind who has studied the problem over
disastrous
the last
20
years.
Disastrous in India, too.
In India as well, yeah. Very definitely.
You advised on that, didn't you?
No, not on centralized planning, no.
That wasn't a fair question anyway.
That's all right. I was over there as an advisor, too.
I've been on the side of the angels on that for a number of years, to a point where I'm supposed to be a friend of Milton's, which is disastrous.
To give advice is one thing. To have it taken is a different one. I agree very much with what Helen Hughes has said, that the more homogeneous a country, the less harm a government will do by intervening. I don't believe it does positive good. I just simply believe it does less harm. But as to antitrust, I am in favor of the laws which make agreements in restraint of trade illegal. Most of the rest of the antitrust apparatus has promoted monopoly instead of hindered monopoly. If you look at where there are monopolistic elements in the world and in the United States, including the multinationals you want to refer to, in almost every case, that monopoly derives from a special grant by government. And therefore, the problem is not how does government enforce competition? How do you keep government from setting up monopolies? That's the real problem if you look at the real world and not at the preamble of the language of antitrust measures and similar laws.
How close are you to what Deason was saying a moment ago, though, in this area? He seemed to be arguing with you that there was a responsibility to make competition work.
The responsibility is to set up a framework of laws and of arrangements under which competition will flourish. And the most...
Inevitably flourish? I mean, or...
Well, so far as I know, I don't know of any case in history in which monopolies have been able to maintain themselves for very long without having government assistance directly come in on their side. The trade union monopolies that Mr. Deason represents would never have the kind of power they do now if it weren't for the special privileges which government has granted to them. I can perfectly well understand his being in favor of such action, of antitrust action by the government, because it really is pro-monopoly action in the main.
Why were those exemptions to monopoly laws given to unions?
Because of the political power of unions, of course. Questioning that.
And because of the tremendous imbalance of power of companies at the time that unions were getting their start.
There's one concluding idea toward the end of your script that I'd like to look at because it seemed to me to be most provocative. You talked about the need for constitutional restraints on governments to prevent them interfering in foreign exchange, free markets, and in foreign trade. Now, what have you in mind, Milton, when you say constitutional restraints?
I have no doubt what I have in mind. If I could persuade the public, I would like it to adopt a constitutional amendment strictly parallel to the constitutional prohibition in the text of the Constitution against the central government, against state governments imposing tariffs or imposts. I would like to have a constitutional amendment which would read, the Congress shall not impose any taxes on imports or give any subsidies to exports, except such as may be necessary. I think the wording of the Constitution is that the states are permitted to do it if it's necessary for inspection. That's the excuse under which California inspects you every time you drive past to see whether you're carrying any plants or fruits or vegetables.
Milton, let me ask you a question. How long do you think that the United States would survive if the United States enacted what you would like to have?
I think the United States would prosper in a way that is hardly imaginable today. It would be an example and a beacon to the rest of the world. What kind of sense does it make? Here we are supposedly the leaders of the world. We are the ones who promote freedom and free enterprise and individual initiative. And what do? We force puny little Hong Kong to impose limits, restrictions on its exports of tariffs in order to protect our textile workers. We go to Japan and we say to Japan, for God's sakes, you got to limit the number of television sets you come out. Instead of doing that, we ought to be setting an example to the world. And if we set the kind of an example to the world that Great Britain set to the world in the 19th century, it would be a tremendous, have a tremendous impact. It would strengthen our moral position in the world. It would strengthen our ethical position in the world. Instead of giving money to underdeveloped countries to produce products which we then refuse to buy and don't let them export to us, we would be saying to the rest of the world, if you produce anything, if you can produce anything that can have a market here, come, we're delighted to buy it, and we'll produce things for you to buy. That's the kind of a pattern I would like to see the United States establish.
Your members buy that?
Never.
Never is a long word, sir.
Yes, you're
and
right.
You must distinguish
and
between...
never say never.
Your union officials would not buy it, but I am not sure your members would not.
No, my members would never buy it either. I cannot conceive of the United States setting itself up to become a target for the rest of the world.
It's not a target?
There would be absolutely nothing that would require or compel any other country to enact any reciprocal agreements to tariffs.
That's right.
And until such time as they had succeeded in dumping in the United States, and I use dumping in the broadest sense of the word, any and every product, either government subsidized by a foreign government, either put there because of multinational corporations' manufacturing facilities in a foreign country, until they had succeeded in absolutely draining us dry.
Draining us dry of what?
Of every asset.
How? What would they do with the dollars they got?
They'd probably buy up as they are now, as the
if they bought up.
Farmland.
Yes, yes.
Okay, let's broaden this on this very argument now, a constitutional amendment argument. We've learned from our union friend he can't sell it and won't sell it. Would business buy it?
Oh no! Speaking
large from large section of the article.
I'm not saying whether I'd buy it. I'm saying whether business would buy it, which was the question. No, when I speak not as a businessman but as a ex-government employee, whenever proposals like that came up, one of the first things people see happen is government, business and labor come in lockstep saying, horrors, horrors, the sky's falling. There's a commonality of interest there, and people get used to what is. They get terribly conservative, and they know how to work the system the way it exists, and particularly the big unions and the big business, and they get very satisfied with it. They can manage it pretty well. And anytime you try to unravel any kind of regulation or restriction or government intrusion, they're philosophically for it, but in the practical world, they don't want you to change the drill. They've just figured out how to work this. Why should you then change it and make it all that more complicated? No, I think you'd get a good deal of reaction, just like you did out of the steel company in your television show.
And what would be international reaction, do you think, as an international economist? Supposing Milton got his amendment, constitutional amendment, which had that effect, how would other countries react to it?
Well, I think Milton's fundamental example of why not be like Britain in the 19th century is wrong. Britain in the 19th century was the industrialized country. It was well ahead of everybody else.
Many decades ahead.
Many decades ahead of everybody else. And it was making larger profits, larger economic rents on its production. And it was doing it at very great cost to the workers in Britain. The workers in Britain were greatly exploited under those circumstances, and we don't want to go back to that. The international situation is much more complex. the countries, there are countries at different levels of development, countries with different social systems, and countries with different social objectives. So I think that the solution, you know, is wrongly founded, and it's millenarian, it's utopian. I think that we have to think of a much more realistic process of discussion, negotiation, such as has taken place through GATT, to get to where we're going without hurting the people who pay for the adjustment, and that is basically the workers, not the economists. Yep.
Could I just comment briefly? I worry about the argument that because of the complexities of international relations, that therefore they must be planned and managed. By definition, we're not capable of managing the world economy. Each instance when we try to do it, it doesn't work out quite the way we intended.
I don't apologize for a moment for being millenarian, because I think unless we know where we want to go, the timid steps that we take in that direction will go in the wrong direction. And if we're going to go in the right direction, we ought to have a view. But I want to be sure to get down on the record a very strong objection to the statement of fact by Helen Hughes about 19th century Britain. I believe it is simply wrong. The workers were not exploited. The studies that have been done recently have shown over and over again that the 19th century was a period in which the ordinary English worker experienced a very rapid and very substantial rise in his standard of life. England does not stand alone. Japan had complete free trade for 30 years after the Meiji Restoration. Japan in more recent years has not. Japan in more recent years is not an example I would cite. But in its early years, it had complete free trade. So I don't believe England stands alone. Now, on the more...
politics of it.
On the politics of it, of course it's not politically feasible. Why? Because it's only in the general interest and in nobody's special interest. Each of us is fundamentally has more concern with our role as a producer of one product than we have as a consumer of 1,001 products. The benefits of a tariff are visible. Mr. Deason can see that his workers are, quote, protected. The harm which a tariff does is invisible. It's spread widely. There are people who don't have jobs because of the tariff, but they don't know they don't have jobs. There's nobody who can organize them. Consumers all over are paying a little more for this, that, and the other thing. They don't recognize that the reason they're paying for it is because of the tariff. The businessman, I have never been in favor. I'm not pro-business. I'm pro-free enterprise, which is a very different thing. And the reason I'm pro-free enterprise...
when you say that?
No. I don't mean to point to you, Don. I point to the business community, because you are an exception. Because
but he conceded there was a tacit alliance across that way prevent you from achieving your purpose.
Oh, there's no doubt that there's such an alliance. In my opinion, the strongest argument for free enterprise is that it prevents anybody from having too much power, whether that person is a government official, a trade union official, or a business executive. It forces them to put up or shut up. They either have to deliver the goods, produce something that people are willing to pay for or willing to buy, or else they have to go into a different business.
Well, there we must leave the argument for this week, and I hope you'll join us again for the next episode of Free to Choose.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.